Hello, everybody, and welcome back to an exciting episode of Film Baby Film. Today, joined by Matthew Sparadolosi, who's been on the podcast before, an attorney from San Diego, a criminal defense attorney, as well as another attorney friend of mine, Tracy Horesco Pearl, who is a law professor, and they came on to join me to discuss Ellen Pakula's classic, All the President's Men. As we discussed in the podcast, the movie definitely came out of contemporary events. I was found myself to be pretty fired up about everything that was going on in the news, particularly after the Helsinki conference. And so I talked to Matt and I talked to Tracy, and they agreed to be on. And I knew it was going to be a terrific conversation. I just didn't know how good it was going to be. I'm very excited for you guys to check that out. This is probably the podcast that I had to do the most editing on, primarily because Tracy and Matt were so articulate and so intelligent that I had to edit myself to make myself sound more articulate, and that required a lot of work. I'm very grateful that these guys took time out of their busy schedules to come and talk to me. It was a really, really great episode. We have some other exciting episodes coming up for the podcast soon. Probably the podcast episode, I may make it a two-parter. It's going to be coming out as I'm going to be doing a overview of one of my favorite directors. I think Visconti and Ingmar Bergman are pretty much neck and neck for me. Maybe it's Bergman number one by a hair. But we're going to do a podcast retrospective on Visconti's film career, which is pretty cool and is definitely something that a lot of people are aware of now, with the Film Society at Lincoln Center doing what they've described as their most successful retrospective ever showing Visconti's films, as well as here in Boston, the Harvard Film Archive, and the Toronto International Film Festival. TIFF also did a retrospective on Visconti. It's very much in the zeitgeist right now. We actually might have somebody from the Toronto area to come on and talk about that. But definitely going to have Matt Gasteyer on, so I'm really excited about that. Yeah, there's a lot to, and I have a couple of other exciting podcasts planned. Like, we may do a John Cho retrospective, which would be pretty awesome. I love Columbus. And then also do some country-specific episodes. So we have a lot going on, a lot coming up. But I definitely want you to check out this episode because this was a terrific conversation. Matt Sparadolosi, Tracy Horesco Pearl, and me discussing All the President's Men. Film Baby Film. Realized afterwards, like, oh my god, did I like ask my friends to do homework for me? So I'm really grateful that you guys came on and wanted to talk about this.
My pleasure. It's always fun.
When's the last time that you guys saw all the? Is this the first time you guys have seen All the President's Men, or is this something that you'd watched before?
I saw All the President's Men was in Washington D.C. It was one of the Screen on the Green films one summer, and so we watched it basically in front of the Capitol, which was awesome. And then since then, I think I've seen it two or three times. I'm trying to think of the last time that I saw it. I think it was fairly recently, but I don't know why I would have watched it. But I feel like I've watched it within the last, year and a half.
I saw it when I was a kid, but without any context or any kind of like understanding of the importance of it. Didn't remember it at all. And then about a year and a half ago, I was over at my friend's house, and he just had it on. And I started watching it from, like, the middle to the end. And I was like, oh, I'm going to put this on my list. This is a good movie. And then when you contacted me, of course, I watched it from beginning to the end again.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had heard about this movie way before I saw it. I had a teacher when I was in the fourth grade who sort of like explained the entire story. And I remember the things I remember from it was that they made a movie out of it and Deep Throat. And that there was like this secret undercover agent. And she said she suspected that it was a group of people, that there was no way it was an actual person. This was all when I was like 10. I had no idea what was going on. But it was like such, it was such a visceral, it's such a visceral memory, because the story as like narrative fiction, just as like a story, is fascinating. And the fact that it actually happened is, you know, just as like mind boggling.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, so yeah, the journalism.
That's a pretty intense social studies curriculum for a fourth grade.
I don't even think it was social studies. It literally could have been like English. And I had this one teacher.
Why not cover Watergate in fourth grade English?
Mrs. Ouellette would just say random stuff, but some of it was so memorable, just because she was a teacher and she would just talk about, you know, whatever she thought, yeah, or whatever was going on in her life. But she was like, some of the stuff that she said was so memorable that I've just never forgotten it. And this was one of the, I think she also talked about The Shining to a bunch of fourth grade students.
Wow.
So, yeah, so that was my intro. And I didn't actually see it, I think, until law school, Tracy. Do you remember? Oh, you do remember, because you worked in the law library.
I didn't, no.
Oh, you didn't work in the law library. No, so the law library for a while at BC had a law movie collection. And I was working,
really?
I was working for Professor Broden. I went to BC Law, as you did, Tracy. And Professor Broden would have me, and I was working in the law library, and one of the law librarians was creating a DVD collection of legally related movies.
Oh, that's great.
And one of them was All the President's Men. And I basically watched the entire collection that summer. Hmm. And so that was actually the first time I watched it. So interesting. So I guess we all know each other. Well, I know Matt and I know you, Tracy. But let's let some of my listeners know who you are. So Tracy, first, why don't you introduce yourself and perhaps tell people why I might have invited you on the podcast to discuss All the President's Men.
Well, I'm not sure about that last part, but I'm Tracy Resko-Pearl, and I am a professor of law at Texas Tech University School of Law, where I teach criminal law and torts, environmental law, and a seminar on criminal justice reform. And I'm also the co-host and co-founder of a law-related film series called Lights, Camera, Law that screened monthly at the Alamo Draft House in Lubbock, Texas. So each month we show a law-related film. We have a panelist or two to talk about the film afterwards. We give out prizes. It's really fun. So if you're ever in West Texas, please look us up. Lights, Camera, Law.
I love it. Matt, do you prefer to go by Matt or Matthew?
Matt's fine.
Matt, what film series do you curate?
I don't actually have a film series that I curate.
So Matt, you've been on the podcast before. You were on the M episode, which was an awesome episode. And interestingly, I think there's a lot of connections between this and M, because M was like one of the great original procedural movies, and this is, you know, this is like one of the, this is like an, the epitome of a procedural. And on top of that, a movie that dealt with the media. But just for people who haven't listened to M in a while, do you want to just introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Matt Spertolozzi. I'm a criminal defense attorney practicing primarily in San Diego, California, but throughout Southern California. I'm a certified specialist in criminal law. I'm a member of various appointed panels. So I accept appointed work for basically high-level criminal cases like murder and things like that in both San Diego County and Riverside County.
And you also are an actor and a voice actor.
That's true, although my practice keeps me pretty busy. But yeah, I was heavily involved in theater throughout my entire life, all the way up until... Well, the last time I was in a play, I was the I played Bobby in Company about 2 years ago at a community theater here in San Diego.
But now primarily the theater that you engage in is the theater of the courtroom.
Yes. Yes. And if you want to see me in action, I argued at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal on a case called, I think it's People versus Dominguez. It's a federal habeas corpus the appeal of a denial of a federal habeas corpus. And so there's a link on YouTube, and you can see me in action, and it's quite titillating.
I'm making a note, so I need to read the New Jim Crow, and I need to see you argue in front of the Ninth Circuit.
Well,
so,
I would argue that not only do you need to read the New Jim Crow, but every American who sets foot in our land on a day-to-day basis should read the New Jim Crow.
Because I agree.
It is probably the most important book written in the past 10 years.
It's a watershed book, I think, for all of law.
Now, this is interesting because this book has popped up at the Brookline Booksmith and at the Harvard Books. Like, I see this book everywhere. And there's a part of me that looks at... This is one of those things. Don't judge a book by its cover. Because you look at the cover, you're like, that's kind of looks like a cheap self-published book. But I... everybody that I have spoken to has said... Because I also... a good friend of mine it works in criminal justice reform. She's actually goes to governors, both Republican and Democratic governors across the country, and works with them on how to enact prison reform in particular. And she that is the number one book that she recommends.
Yep.
So I should point out, and I've already hinted at this, so I know you, Tracy, you and I went to law school. I am, by the way, a member of Good Standing, the Massachusetts Bar Association. I know we watched a movie where a lot of people lost their bar membership, and a lot of people think because I'm not a practicing attorney that that means I never passed the bar or something nefarious happened and I got removed from the bar, but that is not the case. With that being said, I am definitely not a working attorney. I think this is – I sent you guys my notes for this episode. I wanted to do a little background research on impeachment, and I think this is the first time I've actually looked closely at a federal statute, you know, in like a decade. So I'm really saying that to say that that's how I know you, but also anybody listening, you know, these are the real attorneys, not me. And Matt, you and I went to college together.
Yes, UMass Amherst.
We went to UMass Amherst together. So, all right. So now that it's all out in the open, there's no secrets. So great. So I asked you guys to come on to talk about All the President's Men. And how did you guys watch this? Did you guys watch this on DVD, or did you get it on? I don't know if it's on Netflix or iTunes or whatever. But how, like, in what way did you guys actually watch this to prep for the episode? If you did, I don't know. Maybe you just memorized it.
I rented it on Amazon
viewings.
Prime.
You rented it on Amazon Prime? What about
Matt? I think I own the DVD copy, but I don't know that I own a DVD player anymore.
I rented it on iTunes, and I paid $4, and then the next day learned that I could have rented it on Amazon Prime for $2. So I got royally screwed.
So we all know the ending of the movie, right? Like, Richard Nixon is about to be impeached, and instead he resigns as president of the United States. So you know what happens at the end. It's sort of like the Titanic. Like, you know eventually the ship is going to sink. But did that erase the tension for you? Matt, if you want to go first, did you find this to be like a tense movie rewatching it again?
Well, I'll caveat the answer with the circumstances upon which I watched this movie, which was I had just ruptured my Achilles tendon a couple days earlier. So I wasn't like on the edge of my seat, if that's what you're asking. I was laying down, you know, with my foot up.
I'm imagining on a lot of painkillers.
Not so much. I can't really deal with those. I would much rather deal with pain than those. I thought watching the movie how, you know, obviously it's an old movie. I think it came out, 77, 78?
76, yeah.
Just one of the things that struck me was how they just don't make movies like this anymore. If this movie came out today, it would flop. There's no superhero villain. There's no special effects. It's just a good story. That's all it is. And yep. It's well-delivered, well-directed, well-acted. And it would not survive in the movie business today. That wouldn't even be – if that was pitched for a movie today, it wouldn't even get green-lighted. And I thought that was kind of sad because it's such an awesome movie and people just don't appreciate movies like that anymore.
I feel like the only way this could get made is if it was someone huge was insisting on making it. Which, to be fair, I think might have been true at the time. I think, in fact, when Redford sort of went forward and was like, hey, I want to make this movie, they were like, that's great, but you have to be in it because nobody wants to see a freaking... Like, America's already exhausted with politics. The only way they would go see it is if it has, you know, if it has peak Robert Redford.
The Post did exceptionally well last year. And
I'm actually looking up right...
The Pentagon Papers are nowhere near... It's nearly as famous as Watergate, right? And
right.
I mean, there's Meryl Streep and some really good stars in that movie. But I was surprised that movie was made, and I thought it was great.
I was actually, so while we were talking, I was actually looking up, and The Post actually did make a lot of money. The Post was a $50 million budget, made like $177 worldwide. Whereas this movie was insane. This movie was a smash hit. $1.5 million budget. And made $70 million, so that's like a pretty sweet multiplier.
And it won swept all the awards too.
It was nominated for 8 awards. It won 3, including a Best Supporting Actor for Jason Robards.
I love him.
Yeah, he's pretty awesome. So, Tracy, what was your reaction to rewatching the movie?
You know, it's so funny you ask that question because I had a discussion with my husband this morning in which I said, you know, I find this movie really terrifying, and I'm not sure why I find it so terrifying. I think it's something about the soundtrack, right? There's that sort of like church bell that's constantly tolling. And I find the scenes with Deep Throat particularly terrifying for reasons that are sort of unclear to me. But one thing I was thinking about as I watched it this time was how much the X-Files drew on this movie, I think.
Oh, wow.
Right? Because there's that whole Deep Throat subplot in The X-Files, which, you know, to be fair, I haven't watched since the 90s. But I think, if I remember correctly, seems to be based a lot on this movie and how it was filmed.
Well, even just the look of it, like the costume, the way that they're dressed, like that FBI, but involved in some massive conspiracy, a lot of that feeling of paranoia.
Right, right.
That's a really interesting, that's a great call, and I hadn't made that connection.
The other thing I noticed this time, and I think I appreciate this more having lived in D.C. for a number of years, is there's, you know, not that many, but a few of those sort of aerial shots of D.C. at various points. Mm. And I noticed this time there's a really long aerial shot of the Freemason Temple that's just off of DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C., and I was wondering now if this is like a sort of intentional shot in the movie about, you know, conspiracy to have the Freemason Temple being featured prominently. And then there's another shot that features a pretty prominent bank in Georgetown. And so I don't know if those were choices that were made or if I'm digging too deeply into this or looking too deeply into this. But I noticed that on this watch as well.
Wow, the whole Freemason conspiracy.
Yeah, maybe it's all the Freemasons or the Illuminati.
which is awesome because the movie's really interesting. So the first time I watched it, I saw it mostly as like a historical thriller. Mm. And I don't watch it that way now. I think because my current watching of the news has I don't have a very high paranoia level. My baseline for paranoia is like super low. But lately, particularly since the current election, and we'll hold off on talking about that, I think, into like the last half hour of the podcast or later. But just to say that, like, I have a different, my paranoia response is different now. It's a little bit more quickly triggered. And this movie absolutely triggered it for me. Again, even though I knew everything that happened, watching these guys operate in the shadows when they're out in Washington, D.C. at night and going into like shady parking garages and meeting with, you know, secret sources. And I'm just like totally there. Like I'm with them. I'm like, oh, man, where's it leading? And it's the whole time I'm like, wait, I know where it's leading. But for me, the movie totally dragged me along with them. And I was, you know, I was tense for every up and down that the Woodward and Bernstein experienced here.
Yep.
I almost thought that, like, there was a lack of tension for me. So I kind of felt the opposite. I mean, I loved it.
Nice.
It was great. But, like, I'm thinking, man, this is all that happened? Like, what if they were here in 2018 and saw what was going on right now? Like, this is nothing.
First, let's get, like, the basics out of the way. So All the President's Men, 1976 film, based on a book of the same name that was published in 1974. Film stars Robert Redford as Bob Woodward. Robert Redford was also the producer, and I think by all accounts was like the driving force behind getting this movie made. And he played, again, he played Bob Woodward, and Dustin Hoffman played Carl Bernstein. Those are the reporters that were like really driving forward the series of articles about Watergate that that eventually, you know, led to the resignation of Richard Nixon. Jason Robards, as we mentioned, also plays Ben Bradley, who was the editor-in-chief, I guess, of the Washington Post at the time of all of this. And it was directed by Alan Pakula, who directed also Sophie's Choice and a couple of other. So apparently this I had not known this before, but this movie is a part of what they call Alan Pakula's paranoia trilogy. So he had made a couple of other paranoia-infused films before this, Clutton Parallax View, that were a big hit. And he also did Sophie's Choice and The Pelican Brief later on. Yeah, so fun facts. And then we'll just go into, I'll just do like a little snippet of the background, and then we can talk about the actual movie. The movie is about Woodward and Bernstein trying to connect the break-in at the DNC headquarters at Watergate Hotel back to the Nixon presidency. And I think really early on, they like that was what they were trying to do. While they're doing this, they encounter obstacles, both in trying to find sufficient forces to satisfy their editor, as well as external pushback from the Nixon administration. And the stuff that happens in the movie, I know, Matthew, you just said you thought like, oh, this is kind of low stakes stuff. But it really is like it plays like a spy novel. If I was writing a movie script before all of this stuff had come out, if I had written a movie script that had like a high level secret source named Deep Throat, people would be like, "That's ridiculous. You know, you need to rewrite your movie because this is too obvious." But that's actually what happened. So when the five burglars get busted at the Watergate Hotel, these guys are on the case, and the movie ends, you know, with like the low point of the investigation. But what happens in the movie is everything in between these guys working in the shadows. Matt, what was some of your favorite stuff from the film when you rewatched it?
You know, the connections that were made. The first, what was one of the connections they made? Just every time they like got a little bit further along in the conspiracy and found out who was involved, or you know, what was the, you know, who was the person who was accepting money, or you know, the guy who's telling them to follow the money, you know, just every time they made like a revelation, I found myself like with my phone, 'cause I'm not like really a student of history, you know what I mean? So every time they made some kind of revelation, I'm at my phone, like looking up names. I'm like, okay, who's this guy? Who's this guy? And I'm like reading along. So, you know, that was like my favorite part of just like learning how it all unfolded. And you're right. It was like a spy novel where they just like, every few minutes they release like another detail that kind of just moved it further along. And I kind of got this like feeling of like sadness because, you know, back in the 70s and for probably 100 years or however long you might want to go back, but newspaper journalism has been so like important to investigative journalism through local newspapers has been like one of the most important functions of the free press. And today, that's going away. Like, local newspaper investigative journalists are getting thinned out, and there are barely any left. And that's really, really scary.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you guys have both spent time in Massachusetts. Matt, you grew up here, and Tracy, you were out here for at least grad school. The Boston Globe, I mean, we had a couple of movies. We had Black Mass and Spotlight. Both of those were movies that had to do with corruption being unveiled by the Boston Globe investigative investigative reporting unit. And I wonder, like, nowadays, would we be able to take down the Archdiocese of Boston or confront the FBI about, you know, their relationship with organized crime? I don't know.
Didn't the Globe have to move because they couldn't pay their bills?
It's insane. Yeah. And I don't know. So I certainly got that. There definitely was like a sadness about the loss of newspapers. That's definitely like that is definitely a big part of watching this movie. Tracy, what did you feel any of that? What was some of your favorite stuff?
I actually had the opposite reaction. I really liked the fact that the movie focused on the nuts and bolts of investigative journalism, right? And so a lot of the dramatic tension comes from this suspense as to whether or not they're going to be able to confirm the facts that they need to confirm in order to run the story. And I think that's such an important thing to see in today's world. You know, one thing I noticed with my students, and I'm dealing with law students who, you know, are probably smarter and a little bit more, I don't know, aware of current events than the average person. There's this just a really deep skepticism about all journalism and sort of this sense that, you know, all news stories are created equal, that everybody is biased, that, you know, Red State isn't more or less reliable than the New York Times. And that's something I really push back against in my classroom. You know, one thing I'm constantly trying to tell my students is, you know, with these big papers, they have journalistic standards that the reporters have to meet. And that doesn't mean that, you know, they don't have a particular political view, but it means that their stories are more reliable than, say, a story that's appearing on somebody's personal blog or on one of these other sort of quasi news blogs that appears, you know, seemingly every 30 seconds. And so I think this movie is important now because I don't think journalistic standards have changed for the big papers. Although, like you said, I think the big papers have lost a lot of their financial sort of support and their readership in the last, you know, couple of decades.
I agree with both of you. I feel like my take has always been a much larger concern on regional newspapers. Mm-hmm. My take has always been that now that the Washington Post is owned by Bezos, is it Bezos or Bezos? I don't know. Whatever. Now that it's owned by Amazon and they're financially secure, like they're still going to be able to uphold like high standards of journalistic, you know, just plenty of resources they'll be able to pursue in investigative reporting. New York Times is now seems like they're in a stronger financial position than they have been in a while. I'm both optimistic at the national level, but I'm also like super pessimistic at the regional level.
And I think you should. I went to a conference recently where there was a lot of discussion about what people are calling the news deserts. So there are a lot of smaller cities and regions in the U.S. with like no local paper, or even if they do have a local paper, with no investigative journalism. And what the panelists are pointing out is that, you know, like the school board isn't being covered at all. That's true in my own city, Lubbock, Texas, right? Very, very little news about sort of the inner workings of our city government. And what that means is that corruption can go unchecked, that all kinds of bad things can happen or unsavory things can happen without anybody really knowing. And I think that that should be of immense concern. At the same time, I hold myself responsible because I don't even read the local news that's available, right? I mean, I'm so focused on sort of the national news environment that I don't read about the school board even when the story comes out. And so that's something I've been trying to change about myself in the last couple of months.
I don't do the VH1, the like 2018 VH1 pop-up thing. I try to keep my phone away from me when I'm watching a movie, which is super hard. Because I notice a lot of times I will immediately like the first connection I think they make is Howard Hunt. So Howard Hunt was a guy that worked for the White House. I don't know if he was a security consultant, whatever they called him. But he was directly involved with ordering the Watergate break-in. And a couple of the guys actually had his name with his phone number and White House next to it. And that was sort of the first connection that I think Woodward makes to connect the White House to the Watergate break-in. And they're like sitting there on the way that Redford has described it is he wanted the movie to be about the weapons of journalism. He wanted it to be, you're talking about the sounds, Tracy, like the sound of a pencil scratching on a pad of paper. Like that's the sound he wanted you to hear. He wanted you to see phones and people making phone calls and, you know, knocking on doors. And, like, those are the sounds you wanted to make because that was what was going on. One of the first exciting things that happens in the movie is when he's doodling while making a phone call. He's, like, circling Howard Hunt. And then somebody mentions Charles Colson. And so he circles that name. And that was the sort of, like, excitement, which is weird. It's like, how is that exciting? But for me, I was totally drawn in.
Yeah, and they were both One thing that I did not know is that both these guys, Woodward and Bernstein, were basically rookie journalists.
Oh, yeah.
And they cracked probably the biggest story of the decade, and how, like, hungry both of them were, and how, you know, like, if they broke a lead, like, they're on the phone with somebody and a lead broke, all of a sudden they're getting up, getting their jacket on, and running out the door to go chase it down. Like, if this was a maybe not a rookie journalism, would they have been so, you know, excited to go do that work, you know?
Well, Woodward was straight up a rookie. Like, he was, I think somebody described it as Bob Woodward was the lowest paid person at the Washington Post, or he's the lowest paid reporter or whatever. And then, but Bernstein had actually been there for a while, but his issue was he was like bored to tears. He had been working there since he was like 16 years old, but he wasn't catching fire. Like, he was not somebody that was on the fast track or whatever.
Well, and he inserted himself into the story, too.
Yes, he did.
Which is a great scene in the movie of him just going and, like, clandestinely stealing the notes and rewriting the story and the whole...
Which all happened. Tracy, what did you think about the relationship between Woodward and Bernstein?
I thought it was great. You know, the thing that I loved about it was how intellectually honest both of them were, right? There's that moment at the typewriter after Bernstein has stolen Woodward's notes. He's no, he uses a funny verb. I polished it a little bit. Yeah. And he said, it's better. And then Robert Redford takes it and says, yeah, okay, it is better, right? And I was thinking that there are a lot of people who wouldn't have had that reaction, right? And had he had a different reaction, you know, screw you, I've got this, you know, maybe this story doesn't get broken in the way that it ultimately was.
Right. You definitely see them working together. That's really funny, because if somebody had done that to me, like, in law school, if somebody had taken one of my memos and done that, and actually, I'm not saying hypothetically, I'm remembering a specific instance, I was like, fuck you. Like, don't criticize. I mean, they were probably right on all of it, but I was like, don't criticize stuff. Right. Oh, yeah. No, it's great. And so when they write the book, they write it from the same perspective of the movie. In fact, that's actually part of the design. Robert Redford was involved with Woodward and Bernstein before they published the book. While they were still in the middle of reporting, Redford was following the articles and reached out to them about potentially making a movie. And he said one of the things that really, like, fascinated him was how different – in fact, I think it might have been the reason why he made the call – was the profile that came out of Woodward and Bernstein in the New York Times was like, you know, Woodward is a WASP from Yale, whereas Bernstein is, you know, a Jewish guy that had been working for the Washington Post since he was 16 years old. And they were just, like, totally different people. And Woodward was – it seems like Woodward was not a very good writer, which is hilarious to think of now, because is he the most famous living journalist?
Probably, yeah. Yeah.
Right? And to think that at one point, like, when he broke this story, he was considered as a not very good writer.
But it's a different skill, right? I mean, being able to uncover dirt is different than being able to put a word on a page.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. It is. But so when they wrote the book, it was as like, because I'm starting to read the book, which, we were talking about the new Jim Crow, everybody should read it. All the President's Men is one of the easiest nonfiction reads I've ever picked up. It's really, really good. But from right off the bat, you get the sense that they're each given a little bit of license to make fun of each other. And so they write the negative things that they thought about each other at first before they started working together. And that's pretty funny.
I'm going to have to pick that up.
Yeah, it's not bad. And so, Tracy, you mentioned some of the stuff about the aerial shots and some of the attention. I think I mentioned to you guys, or I sent in some of my notes, that, like, that was a very intentional thing. The way that the film was made was they really wanted to make Woodward and Bernstein look small and the stuff they were up against overwhelming. You know, you said some of that look like they have in the X-Files. Was that the sense that you got from watching the film when you would see those aerial shots or the shots of the Mason Temple or whatever?
Yeah, I think I had the feeling that it was David versus Goliath, which it was, right, at the time. And the fact that they were able to untangle not just the sort of vast conspiracy, but vast conspiracy involving the intelligence community and people high up in government, I think is still really amazing to me.
Matt, what was your, did you pick up on any of that? Were you noticing like, oh, wow, like this is some of the stuff about the way that the film was made to really emphasize that David versus Goliath?
Yeah, I picked it up in the dialogue, you know, just the way they were always discussing, you know, or the characters who they would go interview, the subjects of the investigation were always so scared and so apprehensive to talk. And like, I remember, I can't remember this specifically, but one of the first women they spoke to was at her house and they showed up at her front yard and she says like, what are you doing? Somebody might see you, you know? And it's like, who's going to see her? You're in like a suburb in a random house. Like, but she was that worried that she was under surveillance, you know, just that they had to like go inside the house to talk to her or else like get made, you know? So yeah, I definitely picked that up. And if I had to like tie it to, you know, today and what's going on, it's like they did uncover this like vast deep state conspiracy. And it's like, this could swing a way that I don't like and give credence to like the Alex Jones crowd, you know, with their, with their current deep state conspiracy stuff. And so, yeah, but I mean, my mind's always racing with that kind of stuff. So,
but it's an interesting turn, right? And, because back then what Nixon was doing was he was using the FBI, the CIA, the Department of Justice to cover up bad campaign behavior, like really bad campaign behavior. We don't want to downplay that, but we should also like emphasize like he was using all of the institutions of the United States intelligence and like law, the legal community to cover up his own bad behavior and the bad behavior of his campaign. Whereas now, what when they say deep state conspiracy, what they're concerned about is that there's this deep state conspiracy to uncover a crime. It's like, no, that's not a deep state conspiracy. Right. Like that is, but so I like the fact that you mentioned the lady and showing up at her door. That is one of my favorite scenes. Tracy, what are your, did you have any favorite scenes from this that you thought like, wow, that's really interesting or that's really intense?
Gosh, I love all of the deep throat scenes because, you know, for me, for much of the film, I'm not certain to what extent Deep Throat is even reliable and to what extent he's like a low-level like paper clerk that has inserted himself into the storyline, right? Because he could be Alex Jones. Like you don't know at first. And then it comes out, you know, I guess I read this after the movie that he was like the number two at the FBI, that he was super reliable. But as the viewer, if you're coming in fairly cold on the history, I think he's a really interesting character that raises a lot of questions.
And there are still questions around him, right? Because while we know who he is and we know obviously like his intelligence was accurate, now the questions are like, what were his motives? Because Woodward is invested in Mark Felt, who it came out is was Deep Throat. You know, Felt was obviously invested in having a legacy of being the upright citizen. Woodward, to some extent, has a similar incentive to want his story to be the David versus Goliath story, and to some extent, having that halo extended over to his source as well, that he was being at least somewhat heroic in unveiling all of this information to them. But there are people, particularly on the right, that say, well, you know, he is a lot of, either leaker, traitor, or, you know, I think a more articulate and probably somewhat true argument is, this guy's motives were not to protect the United States. This guy was a Hooverite. Like, while Hoover had many motivations, and one of them was patriotism, he also had a lot of other kind of messed up motivations. And so it's not like this guy was totally uncomfortable with skullduggery. What he really was, what a lot of people are arguing is that he was mad he was passed over because he was not made the replacement for Hoover, and Mark felt might have felt jilted.
There's
over that.
Also, so I sort of went down a rabbit hole last year.
Oh, of course, you have to.
I don't know if you've read any of Barrett Brown's writings. He was the journalist that was arrested and ultimately jailed. He was accused of essentially being anonymous, so it was trumped up charges. And he wrote a blog called Barrett Brown's Review of Arts and Letters from Prison, which is one of the best blogs that I've read. But he recommended a bunch of books, and one of them I read, it was called Devil's Chessboard, which is a review essentially of the CIA, but also the larger intelligence community from about 1935 to post-Nixon. And the sort of thrust of this book is that the intelligence community has always operated as essentially a fourth branch of government that's gone unchecked, and posits that some of the things that we saw with Kennedy and with Nixon are actually the intelligence community very purposefully feeding information to journalists, or being the deep state in the way that sort of, you know, the crazy right wing conceptualizes them right now, which is that the intelligence community had its own reasons for wanting Nixon to essentially be deposed. And I think viewing that movie, having read some of those materials, made me, you know, question on sort of a deeper level what Deep Throat's motives were. Was it personal? Was there somebody behind him that was saying, no, this is actually the intelligence that we want to feed? I don't know, and I don't think we'll ever know.
So yeah, the like his motives and what they were, ultimately, like, the good and evil aren't just sort of a negative and positive, right? They're just this gray area. It's kind of like the same question with James Comey, you know, like, is he an altruistic truth teller? Or does he have some motives, you know, as well? Obviously, he came out and gave those interviews last year after he had been fired.
Right.
You know, why didn't he come forward before he was fired, you know, with information that was clearly into the public interest?
And that,
you know,
to me, is one of the most fascinating aspects of sort of the entire Trump administration, is the extent to which Trump has taken on the intelligence community, right? Because from my vantage point,
yes.
I mean, I've said this before on social media, like, there is one rule of the American presidency, and that's that you don't screw with the intelligence community, right? That, like, as long as you're sort of letting them do what they want to do, things will be fine. And Trump seems to be acting all the time in blatant violation of that rule. And so I've just sort of wondered about what's happening behind the scenes in the intelligence community. How do they view his presidency? You know, what is their sort of approach to dealing with, you know, all of these issues that have arisen. And I think, like you said, Comey in particular, I think, is a fascinating sort of character study in all of this.
You can tell we want to talk about Trump, John.
Oh, yeah. No, so I'm actually making notes because I want to mention two more things about this movie and then talk a little bit about Nixon. And then I want to open up the floodgates and go ham on Trump, on DJT. I don't even like saying that word, Trump. It just feels icky. So I have to say, I think my favorite scene in this movie, definitely is the scene where they talk to the bookkeeper. And I love the way that this is shot. And I think people have talked about the way that this is shot. But remember, because it's Dustin Hoffman, it's Carl Bernstein, and he's in one room, and he sort of breaks into, which, by the way, apparently Carl Bernstein says this is all true, this is how it happened. Apparently he, like, sort of barged into this woman's house who didn't want to talk, but her sister kind of let him in, and then he barges in, he says, give me a cigarette. He sits down in one room, she's in the other room. The way that they frame the shot is, she is behind like a lattice stairwell, like not a fence, but like a banister, and so it looks like you only see her through the bars of this stairwell, and so it looks like she's behind bars, like she's in a cage. And then when she finally decides she wants to let the truth out, she, like, comes out of the shadows, she's freed from her cage, and then she sits down with Bernstein and she starts, like, they go through that whole thing. He's like, well, just, you know, I'll just say initials and you say whether or not they controlled the slush fund. And, like, that whole thing, I just love that.
Yeah, and they totally, they come up with this wonderful ruse plan to get the information out of her, where they're going to try and confirm who the initials are. And if she doesn't if she reacts the way she reacts, they'll know whether she confirms or denies it.
Oh, yeah. Well, they came because they come back and she's like, what are you doing? Get off my lawn.
Yeah, exactly.
People are going to see you. But no, they do. They do a ruse. And you sort of see at this point, they're working together much better. Apparently, so Redford said that him and Hoffman did something interesting where they memorized each other's lines specifically so that later on in the film, Woodward and Bernstein would be acting like the same person. That to signify that they were like so close, working so closely together, and their relationship arc had come so far. Whereas at the beginning they were like stealing each other's work and retyping it. Now they're able to complete each other's sentences, and so that happens with them. But yeah, they totally create a ruse, and you also get the sense, and they mentioned this a few times in the movie, and Redford has said this, and Woodward and Bernstein have admitted to this, they were really aggressive reporters. Mm-hmm. They did some things that were definitely on the line of, ethicality. Is that a word? Like, they were definitely like in some ethical gray areas to push people to give them information that some of the people really didn't want to give them.
So what they did in that scene where they used the ruse to get her to confirm information is actually a tactic that police officers, detectives use all the time in criminal investigations. They pretend that they already know what the answer is. If the detective has a theory that you know, something is true or something happened, you know, they'll pretend that they already know it's true, and they'll make up the fact that they already have independent evidence of it, and they'll ask the perp to confirm the theory. And they'll tell the perp, you know, we already know this is true, so you better just tell us now. And, you know, inevitably the perp always says, well, if you already know, I'm just going to confirm anyway. Yet, in the meantime, the police didn't already know. They didn't have any corroborating evidence, and now they have a confession. And that is actually, well, I find it to be a little bit dishonest. But that's actually legal for the police to do that. And it's funny to see that tactic used by investigative journalists who are kind of acting like criminal detectives.
That's a question I get from all my law students. You mean the police can lie to me? Like, yeah.
Yes, they can. They can lie to you. you can't lie to them, though. If you lie to them, that's another charge on top of your sheet.
The way that this movie works is the very beginning of it is a sheet of white paper that you think is just a white screen. And it eventually there's some typing that comes out on it. And then the ending of the movie is the same thing, and it's Nixon resigns. I didn't recall. There's a lot about this movie that I did not remember. Like, I did not remember just how wide the Nixon cover-up conspiracy went. I didn't realize that basically everybody in the federal government that had law enforcement or intelligence capabilities was involved somehow, which is still sort of insane to say, but whatever. I didn't remember that this movie ends with them basically at their lowest point, because Sloan had given them information that he was going to testify, that I think it was Haldeman knew about the slush fund, or was directing the slush fund or something like that. But then is never asked about it in the grand jury, and then says, you know, I was never asked about Haldeman. I don't know where the Washington Post got their sources. And it looked like Bernstein and Woodward were wrong. Nixon is getting inaugurated, and Watergate is dead. Like, the Watergate story is dead. That's where the movie ends.
Right.
How did you guys, Tracy, how did you feel about the movie sort of ending at the low point? And then just having like typing that says, oh, and by the way,
it's
Nixon
sort of
resigns.
Weird because they essentially just chopped out the second half of the book, right? Like they just sort of, but on the other hand, I think it makes the movie more watchable, right? Because, you know, you sort of have this low moment and then they get that last sort of final puzzle piece. And then it sort of is presented as everything unraveling from there. Like, once they get that last piece of information in place and they've got sort of the structure in place, then all of the other stories follow from it. You know, I wondered this time if that's in fact what happened, that they reached sort of this critical moment, they got that last puzzle piece, and then everything fell into place, or if it continued to be a battle, you know, all the way up to the end. And so I'd like to read the book, the second half of the book in particular, to learn more about that.
And yeah, Matt, I wonder what did if you... their audience, like, You know, because I actually have not read the book, but it's definitely going to be on my list now. But I didn't know that they, I didn't know until you told me, Tracy, that they had actually just cut out a lot of important
stuff.
That's
what I read, at least,
that
online.
Explained.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. No. Oh, no, this is no question. And again, this is a Redford decision. So what happens is Redford basically reaches out to Woodward and Bernstein and actually influences the style of the book. Their book was going to be specifically about it was going to be told from the perspective of like Watergate burglars, and it was just going to be about the White House. They were not going to be a subject of the story. But the at the same time that they hit the low point where it seemed like the Watergate story was dead, and it seemed like Sloan had just blown up their latest article connecting everything to the White House, at the same time there was a report done about Woodward and Bernstein, a profile done about them, and that's when Redford reached out to them, and he had always insisted, he said, that the movie would end at that point. He wanted it to end like right there. I don't know if that was just because it was his original vision, or if it was because he, for me, the reason why it works is because I like the, it's sort of like Eminem at the end of 8 Mile, right? He wins this big competition. In this case, they actually lose. Although now Deep Throat has given them all this additional information, letting them know they're going down the right path. And they know that the only reason why Sloan hadn't testified, you know, to the stuff that they told him was because they were never asked and the fix was in. So they sort of know there's a lot more to go, and they just go back to work. In 8 Mile, Eminem wins the big rap competition, and then he just goes off and he's like, I got to go back to work. Like, there's still work to be done. Right. You know, the legend doesn't get made by a stroke of genius or a stroke of luck, and then I just go home and, you know, I'm an Eminem. No, it's like, no, you have to work really hard to, you know, bring down the frickin' president of the United States. And for me, I really like the ending. You know, you see Woodward and Bernstein just like typing away, doing the thing that they were doing at the very beginning of the movie, which is like working their asses off to break the next story that they're going to break. I really like the ending.
As they're typing, he's getting sworn in again for his second term.
Right. Right.
Which is like, at that point, I'm like, wait a minute. I thought they won in the end.
So we should talk a little bit about Nixon before we go on to Trump. Certainly we want to leave plenty of time for the current stuff, but one of the things that I found interesting when I watched this movie was how the hell could any of this stuff go on? And I had actually done some reading about the Kennedy administration in particular. And I've read other things, and there have been lots of rumors. The idea is that, and this goes back to what you were saying, Tracy, the idea was everybody was doing this. There are, like, Nixon essentially thought that Kennedy had bugged his office and potentially bugged like private planes that he was flying on. Like Nixon really thought that this was how politics work. In addition, Hoover was acting this way, was, you know, who didn't J. Edgar Hoover have a wiretap on at one point or another? You know, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, I think the fucking Kennedys had like it was. And on top of that, and all of this is like in an era of raging communist paranoia. You know, the Cold War was raging and that was real, but also like almost an overreaction and that mentality going through. So people were willing to do stuff that otherwise would seem crazy and immoral at that time. Does that sound anything like what you guys have read or what your thoughts were on that era and how, like, the environment that some of this stuff happened?
I think that's right. You know, I might disagree to this extent. I mean, I think that based on what I read, we had a very unchecked intelligence community during this time period in the U.S. You know, Kennedy tried to roll that back a little bit unsuccessfully. But I think that sort of the Red Scare was this really convenient justification for a lot of this very unsavory behavior on the part, not just of the intelligence community, but on the part of politicians and people in government at all levels.
And Matt, have you given any thought to this? Is this something that the movie brought up or you were wondering or thinking about?
I don't know if I had anything to say on this. It's like, well, what has really changed since then? You know, I mean, it seems like just the unfortunate state of how our government worked then and probably in the 80s and the 90s and now, you know, so.
So I think we should just get into it. This is so, like I said, I reached out to you guys immediately after the Helsinki conference, and I was like, I need to talk with some smart people,
which went really well, by the way. I think
it's a high point.
And I was like, all right, so I need a cover to do it on my podcast. So let's talk about All the President's Men, and So I think the first thing I want to ask you, Matt, is what are some of the similarities you see between, and I think you already started hinting at this, what are some of the similarities you see between what was going on in All the President's Men and what you see with Nixon and all of that to some of the stuff that you see in the news now?
Oh, God. It's like, how much time do we have? Well, first of all, I want to say about the Helsinki, and before I answer your question, did you see a week or two ago the congressman, I don't know his name, but he's from Massachusetts, from my district, Brockton. He gave a really impassioned speech to the House about the Helsinki conference, and if you have a chance to see it, it's really awesome. I'll have to get his name and send it to you. But yeah, what struck me, if I had to compare the movie, you know, and the historical facts about Watergate to now, is how it's amazing to me how Trump seems to have a few dozen Watergates under his belt. Like, there are so many individual conspiracies that have been involved with Donald J. Trump that alone would be equal or worse than Watergate. I mean, even before Trump was elected, it was within the public knowledge that he defrauded students by opening up a fraudulent university. Right. Just that alone is, you know, is necessary and sufficient to disqualify him from office. You know, just that. And he has like a few dozen of conspiracies that are equally bad.
His Trump University stuff is like, Where would I rank it on the things I dislike about Trump? I mean, it's like got to be like 50 or lower.
But again, I agree. There are much worse things that he's done. But,
isn't that crazy?
And I'd love to just apply for some job somewhere and put Trump University on my resume. Just some job I don't care about.
Tracy, what are some of the similarities that you saw? What are some of the things you thought of? You're watching this movie, you're like, oh man, I've heard this before. I'm seeing this now, or whatever.
I had a similar reaction to Matt, which is that Watergate is sort of one conspiracy, or maybe a small collection of conspiracies. And then I thought about the allegations that we're looking at now, and there seems to be a new one like every 12 hours, right? Like, how do you?
Oh man.
Even begin to sort of follow any of those threads from beginning to end, right? I saw more differences than similarities, though, in this sense. I mean, you know, Nixon, say what you will about him, but he has always struck me as somebody who was very intelligent, right? Who had a very clear vision for his political life. He had a distinct ideology. He also was incredibly paranoid, right? And had a very questionable relationship with ethics of any sort. And I find that really different than Donald Trump, right? I mean, Donald Trump has mm-hmm. never struck me as somebody who has a particular ideology or has a particular vision for his political life. And so unlike Nixon, I think, who, you know, I find a credible head of a vast conspiracy, I just don't feel that way about President Trump.
Yeah, I think one of the most obvious similarity, like the big picture one, is that just the involvement of cover up. Like, it isn't just, hey, I did this thing and then I lawyered up and then I just, you know, acted as president and waited for the rest of it to play out in either one of their cases. But there's also a lot of differences in that, like the way that these two handle cover-ups in some ways couldn't be any more different. In the one hand, you have Nixon, who seems to be the quarterback of, like, the not even a quarterback, a CEO of a massive corporation of corruption. Whereas you have this other guy who seems like it's him and his son and his Twitter account. And that's like nobody else will follow this guy. Like, his own people are just taking notes, being like, I'm not going to do any of the stuff this guy says.
I feel like the Trump administration is like a donut. Like, I think that there are people around Trump who have a very particular ideology, who have very specific ends in mind, right? Who may be willing to pursue unsavory pathways to get there. And in the middle, I think you have sort of this power vacuum or this sort of cipher who, you know, has no distinct sort of opinions about things or who's sort of constantly changing. And I think that that just creates an even more difficult situation to sort of unravel than with Nixon. Like you said, like, Nixon's sort of the CEO. He's like the godfather of this sort of criminal conspiracy, and you can sort of trace, you know, the actions and who was involved. And, I kind of think that would be impossible with this administration.
Well, and I think I will say about Nixon that at least when he got caught, he had the decency
to resign,
to do the right thing in the end, which is resign and say, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But I don't see
and,
that.
And, like,
with
this
Donald
is the
Trump.
Moment,
I mean,
this
he's
is
already
the moment
has
that every law professor is waiting for right now, right? Which is that, you know, there's enough evidence to indict either Trump or his kids. And first question, can you indict a sitting president? And second, can he pardon himself, right? Or if Trump turns around and pardons his children, what then, right? It's like this kind of,
well, he already has Giuliani on television talking about how collusion is not a crime now.
Right.
Oh man.
Oh, and it's like, okay, then your right, target right. is moving, buddy. there is another movie coming out August 31st. Did you guys know about this? It's a documentary specifically about Trump's connections with Russia.
Oh, interesting.
And it's going to be released on Netflix. I'll have to get the name. I wish I had it.
So I had seen that this guy is starting to do the rounds, the press rounds, but yes. I haven't actually learned anything about the documentary, and I'm certainly interested. I mean, one of the big differences between these two is that Nixon did almost all of his stuff in private. And that is a huge difference because, oh gosh, I mean, what are some of the things that does? I mean, on the one hand, it made it harder to believe. Like, you read a lot of the people that were around this time, like Cass Sunstein. I read his book, Impeachment, A Citizen's Primer. And he basically said that when he was following this stuff, he didn't believe it. He believed that Nixon, you know, had nothing to do with it. And this was just like some Watergate and all the stuff associated with it. It was just like a few bad actors in his administration. And so there's a lot of skepticism that this really could be this vast conspiracy that it ended up turning out to be. Whereas now, basically, the president goes on Twitter just about every week or every day and admits to something new. And it sort of messes with your mind when it's like, wait, could this really be as bad as it is? Because Nixon kept everything secret, and then when it finally came out, it was like, oh, of course he kept it secret, and of course he was guilty, and all this other stuff. Whereas now it's like, the president is doing all of his obstruction and collusion basically out in the open.
Yeah. Well, I think that goes to Tracy's point that, I mean, honestly, and I've said this before, and people disagree, but honestly, I just don't think Trump is that smart. I think he's kind of a dumb guy. I mean, he, like you said, he just confesses to the crimes. You know, when he went on TV to talk to Lester Holt and admitted that he fired James Comey because of the Russia investigation,
While he was talking about himself in the third person, I think we all forget how weird he is sometimes, because some of the stuff he does and we just like try to normalize it. But he was he said, you know, I said to myself, this Trump thing with Russia, what the fuck? Why would you say, like, who talks like that? Even when you're nervous or anxious, you don't talk like that.
For me, this yeah. sort of goes to a larger thing. Like, for me, the big lesson so far of the 21st century is that we just have to suspend disbelief. Like, I remember on 9/11, right? People, I was sitting, you know, in my college dorm room watching this unfold, and people saying, like, you know, this is terrorism. And, like, me turning them to say and saying, you know, you mean to tell me that multiple people hijacked multiple planes all at the same time and managed to, like, fly them into, like, that just is not, that sounds crazy, right? But sure enough, that was correct. And then, you know, it just seems to have sort of progressed from there, where things that just, if you sort of say them out loud, sound patently ridiculous, are in fact the truth, right? Like, I remember that right. there was that moment last year where there was a whistleblower at the NSA and her name was Reality Winner, and me just thinking, like, yeah, yes. Okay, so right, lesson again, we suspend disbelief. And it's been like that with this entire administration. It's like, day by day, if you say out loud what's happening, you sound like a fool or like some sort of crazy conspiracy theorist that's like crawled out of a prepper cave somewhere, where in fact what you're saying is absolutely what is in fact happening.
Well, that's why I had to stop watching House of Cards even before the Kevin Spacey controversy. But I was in the middle of a season, and I'm thinking, this isn't even as exciting as what's going on in reality.
Oh, yeah, not even close. So, Matt, so you do criminal defense work, and a lot of what's been going – now, I am going to ask kind of a legal question. I wanted to, like, avoid it, but whatever. I have, you know, a criminal defense attorney here. I want to know what your thoughts are on this. Just the stuff from the public record, without any, like, without any extrapolation.
Yes, the answer is yes.
So,
yes.
So what?
There's enough information in the public record to make a case for conspiracy to commit treason.
So let me,
and that's been true for over a year.
Let me ask. So let me say the two specific things that I think of. Donald Trump Jr. when he said, "If you have this stuff, I love it." Do you think that that is enough, at least for Donald Trump Jr.? I think obviously DJT knew about the meeting, and I think that there's going to be, multiple sources that are going to come out, and like that's going to come out when Mueller releases his report. But even before that, Donald Trump Jr., do you think that that is enough for conspiracy right there, just the email and taking the meeting?
Well, look, when you make a case for conspiracy, right? Conspiracy is based on an agreement and an overt act. Okay, that's the basic, an agreement to commit a crime plus an overt act, that makes a conspiracy. In order to prove that, you always have to have circumstantial evidence. There's virtually no conspiracy trials where direct evidence, and I think we all, maybe the audience, but us three at least know the difference between the two, right? You know, because you have to, you know, in order to prove the intent elements of the crime, you know, an agreement, you have to intend to agree to commit a crime. And nobody's going to admit that unless you have, you know, potentially you have one of the co-conspirators who flips and testifies, and so that might be direct evidence, but sometimes you don't. I mean, I would invite you to go watch any federal conspiracy trial, criminal trial on conspiracy, and you'll see the government make a case against poor non-white people for conspiracy with far little evidence than what's involved in this case. And so, yes, the circumstances of Trump making a public announcement that they're going to have information on Hillary very soon, followed by them setting up a meeting with the Russian government, going to that meeting, followed by not the Russian government, but Russians, right, who were connected to the government, followed by Russians' known hacking. Those three facts, right, in a row are enough to make a case for conspiracy. That's circumstantial evidence right there, just on those three facts.
So, Tracy, I want to give you a chance to say something, but first I need to ask this follow-up question. What about the invitation to hack Hillary's emails and then the releasing of the timing of the actual hacking of the emails on July 27th? Do you think that that is additional information that's relevant?
Matt, are you asking me?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm laughing because, again, saying it out loud, it seems a little ridiculous.
Crazy, right? Right. That's, God. That's why, the Mueller investigation, what is the, it's all there already.
So, Tracy, what are some of your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I would agree with everything Matt said. I for me, I'm most curious about what charges Mueller may be investigating or pursuing, right? Like, we don't know what the charges may ultimately wind up being, right? And I don't know that, I don't know. If I'm Mueller, I don't know that I want to hang my hat on conspiracy, right? Mm. Like, I just don't think it's going to be that politically savory for people. But I agree with Matt that absolutely just sort of on its face, what we know is enough to establish a strong prima facie case.
So sometimes you can, in art school, they'll have you do an exercise where you don't draw the person you want to draw. You just draw all the stuff around them so you can get the negative space. Mm. And so you end up drawing the person. Well, if we look at that from what if we want to try to read the tea leaves and figure out what Mueller's honing in on, you could just look at Giuliani's reactions, and Giuliani is pretty fiercely saying, like, we will not let the president talk about firing James Comey, which is like everybody in the universe is thinking obstruction of justice. So it seems like that's going
to
be
the easiest charge, right? I mean, that's the easy one it seems to go for. I mean, if you're going to, first of all, I don't believe that there's some vast conspiracy with Russia to, I don't know, that Trump is sort of Manchurian candidate. I think there's enough for conspiracy. I think there's enough for all kinds of election tampering or election fraud. But the Comey firing seems like the easiest charge to bring. I don't know, Matt, do you agree with that?
It's the easiest because it's so goddamn obvious, but it's the least satisfying for me
personally. Right. It's sort of like just bringing a conspiracy charge. Like, I don't know. It's not that satisfying to me.
Yeah, it's kind of like Al Capone, It's like, he was racketeering, but in the end they got him on tax evasion. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like,
right.
You wish you could have. Wish you could have.
Present company excluded. The smartest person I know is this young guy who used to work for a hedge fund and now is an actuary. He's like, he raced through his actuarial exams. He went to Harvard, studied economics and math while he was there. And he's like crazy smart. He and I discussed this the other day and it totally blindsided me when he was like, no, we absolutely shouldn't impeach the president. And I was like, whoa. I was like, wow, that was not where I was expecting you to go with this. And so one of the arguments that he makes is that, this is all just a waste of time. You'll never get the votes in the Senate. And, he has a few other arguments. I think the argument he really wanted to make was, this isn't that big of a deal. So he was going with occlusion is not that big of a deal argument. But also, this is a majority, we democratically elected this guy. You can't prove to me that this swung the election. Just wait until he's out of office. I don't find any of those particularly satisfactory. But an interesting question is, what is the point of impeaching a president if you know you're not going to get the votes in the Senate? And I don't know that we do know that, but let's assume we do know. Is it worthwhile to spend a lot of time to impeach a president in the House and then, to make the case in the House, do all that investigation, make the impeachment, and then to potentially go to the Senate just to know that you're going to lose? Matt, what are your thoughts on that?
I think it's definitely necessary as part of a democratic government. I mean, we, especially when the threat, to our country is still active. I mean, we're expecting that the Russians will continue to try and illegally influence our elections. And so it's not like, oh, well, no harm, no foul. That's not it at all. That's way off base. And who's to say that Republicans won't stand up and impeach him if confronted with incontrovertible evidence? I mean, we just don't know the answer to that question.
Tracy, what are your thoughts on that?
Gosh, as sort of, I don't know, personally satisfying as it would be to see, some of the bad faith actors of the Trump administration taken down. You know, I think I agree with your friend that I worry about the long-term effects of impeachment. You know, we're in a really precarious place politically in this country, and I worry a lot about impeachment mobilizing segments of the right that we don't particularly want mobilized.
Yep.
And, you know, I think I agree with Matt. What I want is I want a full report on Russia's interference in the election, right? Like, that to me is the most important sort of open question that we have, right? To the extent that we're being tampered by a foreign power, we all need to know that as Americans. You know, my greater fear here is that I think the election of this president has exposed for me an appetite for autocracy in this country that I didn't think was there. And I think we got lucky this time around because, like I said, I think Trump is not a particularly effective president, but I worry about the next time around who we might elect. And I worry that impeaching Trump might agitate the forces that got him elected to begin with and lead to something worse long term. And also, honestly, I don't want Mike Pence as president. So it's not like we're getting anything much better than Trump if he was impeached and he was convicted, which won't happen, or he resigned, which I also don't think will happen.
Well, it's interesting. Jake Tapper has made the same comment. Was it on Seth Meyers or Colbert? He basically said, he's like, look, whatever. I don't know if this guy could be impeached or you know, if people could get arrested or whatever. He said the main thing he wants is to know the truth. He wants at the end of the day, because he feels like all the gaslighting and all of the – and there's – like, whatever you think about the legalities, whatever you think about the state of play in terms of how much we actually know in terms of fact and evidence, there's no question that this president has – like Nixon, just an inordinate appetite for dishonesty and lying and misrepresentation. I think much greater than Nixon. Like, I feel like this guy is just, he tells lies. He tells a lot of lies that aren't even necessary. Like, he is just a liar. And, it would be nice to fix that. And it's like an important part of democracy is the idea that the American people, Congress, like the general public has the facts. And this has been like definitely an attack on facts and the truth.
Yep.
Guys, I'm so sorry, but I have to go.
Oh, thank you so much for your time. Before you go, is there anything that either of you guys want to say before we end this really terrific conversation?
No, it was fun. Nice meeting you, Tracy.
Awesome.
It'd be nice meeting you too. And watch the movie. Read the book. It's, I think, an important movie and an important moment in American history.
Professor, thank you very much for your time. Matthew.
Thanks, John.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, John. Bye, Tracy.
Thanks, guys.
Talk to you soon. Bye.